You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Gwendolyn Keist is the four-time Bram Stoker award-winning author of The Haunting of Velkwood, The Rust Maidens, Reluctant Immortals, Boneset and Feathers, and Pretty Marys all in a row. Her short fiction has appeared in outlets including Nightmare, Best American Science Fiction, Fantasy, Tor, Nightfire, Titan Books, and The Dark. She's a Lambda Literary Award winner, and her fiction has also appeared in the This Is Horror Award for Novel of the Year. Her new collection from Raw Dog Screen Press, what a great name for a great publisher, is The Haunted Houses She Calls Her Own. It's a short story collection. Thank you for joining me, Gwendolyn.
Thank you so much for having me back. I always love talking with you.
I have to say, when I first heard about horror, and I think when many people hear about horror, they think gore and violence, as with most genre fiction, you know, you hear science fiction, you think rocket ships, you hear fantasy, you think elves, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think the power of all genre fiction is to use the elements and tropes of genre to externalize the kind of inner conflicts we have, so that in the horror genre, the monsters we keep within ourselves are all of a sudden outside and knocking at the door. So we're forced to deal with them in a manner that we really can't deal with them when they're all locked inside. This new collection, I think, does a fabulous job of using the horror genre to explore a variety of emotions in a variety of ways. And you have some kind of ghost stories. You have really just over-the-top stories and everything in between. You go through within the horror genre. I think you take on every genre that is included in the horror genre in this collection and explore a bunch of themes. Or actually, I think one theme, because one thing about this book is this is a book by a fully grown-up woman who understands human beings and has lived among us long enough to be able to explain us to ourselves.
Steve, I'll be being a fully grown adult, though. Don't get hasty.
Yeah, well, I'm pushing senior citizenship, and still, I'm often told you haven't grown up yet. So I'm happy by that. Yeah. Let's talk about the short story is a wonderful genre, and in fact, it was invented in American fiction. It was really invented by Edgar Allan Poe. And who?
Yeah.
So, talk about the decision to write these stories as short stories. There's, in fact, one from Lucy Westerna's diary, quite a fun one, but it's outside of, I think, the scope of your novel that deals with Lucy Westerna, and it deals with that in a different way. So talk about the decision to write these ideas into short stories. Mm-hmm. When does that happen for you, or how?
I really started writing short fiction way more than I ever, wrote novels. I've always loved short stories, like you said, growing up with Poe, and, I've always loved Shirley Jackson's work and Angela Carter and Ray Bradbury, Richard Matheson. So there's just, there's so many great horror. And Stephen, I love some Stephen King's short fiction. I'm one of those people that actually like his short fiction better than his novels. Like, I'm like that rare person that I'm like, if I'm going to read Stephen King, I'd much rather read some of the stories in like Night Shift and things. But, I think that horror is so well suited for short stories because many of these themes work so well in these kind of like short bursts of exploring fear or unease or this sense of being an outsider. And I think that that can just work so well in a horror short story. And you know, you gave the example of the eight people who murdered me, the one from the perspective of Lucy and Dracula. And yeah, that really was the starting off point for Reluctant Immortals. That was kind of the initial inspiration for the full novel. But it was really fun to kind of reimagine Dracula from her perspective and what that would be like from this person that had been sidelined. And that is such a neat exercise as a writer. And it can be so cathartic to take a character that you love and kind of flip it around and say, let's see things from their perspective and get this different idea of a story that we know so well. And I think short fiction can do those kind of retellings in particular really well.
The very first story in this book is from a David Cronenberg inspired anthology, and as you read the story, you can absolutely see the Cronenberg in it. But it deals with something I think that Cronenberg is, he is not qualified to deal with, which is childbirth. He's great at lots of stuff. I'm not sure that, I'd say you're the gal to do that, and this story covers it. Talk about creating this scenario and using the inspiration of David Cronenberg to tell this story.
Yeah, so that was such a fun anthology to get an invite to because I've been a Cronenberg fan for years. So the story is called A New Mother's Guide to Raising an Abomination, and it's from the perspective of this woman who's pregnant at the beginning of the story and ends up giving birth to this basically little monster baby. But the monster baby, I actually like to say the monster baby is pretty cute. It's a pretty cute monster baby from what we gather from it. But the whole thing is, I always loved the brood, which we really does. Cronenberg does deal a little bit with childbirth there because she sort of gives birth to those creatures. But you know, I always loved that, and I think that again, I like to take these ideas and sort of play with them. And I was like, basically, it kind of was like, well, what if this little monster isn't just this like snowsuit wearing evil creature that runs off like in the brood? I'm like, what if this is actually a cute little monster baby? And what if this monster baby just wants to hang out and be left alone, but it's the world that's angry at this monster baby for daring to exist? And that really was kind of like the starting point for it. And there's like some dead ringers, like kind of callbacks when she's giving birth, because I was thinking, all of the scenes in that. And there's insects and stuff like that, like, because I love the fly. But it definitely, the brood in particular was what I was thinking about, because I love the idea of, again, taking a perspective that, oh, it's the monster baby. And so often it's like, oh, the monster baby is evil. But I'm like, what if the monster baby just wants to grow up and just like live her little monster baby life, and people don't want her to? And so that's really the starting point for this story. That's like one of my favorites. As soon as you start talking about it, I always smile because I'm like, oh, little monster babies just wanting to be monster babies.
I like the sense of, I guess, sisterhood in the novel, because it really, it's not just the monster babies, it's all the mothers of the monster babies want to be together and gain strength from that, which I think is an enduring. It's a hint as to what's to come in this collection, because these are stories very specifically from a woman's point of view, and they're terrifying, but also they're educational for a guy, eh?
Yeah, there is a lot of sense of like coming together and community and finding other outsiders like you. That's definitely a theme in that story, but in the collection in general. So that is a big thing for me of like, what happens when the person who's been othered or on the outside does find other people like them? And how can we come together and try to form our own weird little communities of just people like us? I like that idea.
The story, the Sea Witch of the World's Fair, was one of those stories that is going to send every single reader to Wikipedia to look up the World's Fair and find out that yes, indeed, that place did exist. So talk about finding that.
Yes. So my husband and I during the pandemic watched this documentary on Salvador Dali, and at the World's Fair, he actually built this installation called The Birth of Venus that it was like a weird surrealist fun house basically that you could walk through at like just on the whole World's Fair, thoroughfare. And it was like there were mermaids and there was all this weird, like Dali furniture. And it was very bizarre and like really truly like I describe it in the story, I think, fairly well, but there are a lot of pictures. So, like, I do want people to like Google this because I was like, how had I never heard of this before? It was wild. And so I immediately started thinking, like, I have to use this somehow in a story. It's such a fun idea. And sometimes it's stuff like that, I'm like, even if nothing else, somebody might find out that this was real. And I love that as a writer when you can be like, hey, this really weird thing that I found, maybe people will look it up, like you said, on Wikipedia and be like, oh, wow, that's real. So that alone is enough that I'm like, I hope some people look it up. But because there were mermaids in it, there were these girls, you know, swimming through tanks and stuff and lounging around as mermaids, my horror brain goes to, well, what if there's a real mermaid and she's trying to hide in plain sight until she's able to get hired as a mermaid in this exhibit so she can actually be herself, you know, in front of people, but they think it's a costume. So it was like, that was immediately where my horror brain went. And so I was kind of off and running at that point.
Reading the story was like experiencing a very dark Disneyland ride.
It was kind of like that. I think it predated Disney, though. I think Disney stuff didn't happen till the 50s. So I think this was before, which is really wild. But it has like a surrealist Disney feel from all of the like pictures and stuff. And I think there is some video as well. It's just wild. It's like a wild little piece of like Americana.
When we think about the horror genre, we think about horror movies. And so, of course, you do a wonderful job with the girls from the horror movies. So talk about that, because that's a wonderful perspective. We see so many, you know, beautiful girls going, just before they're slain or just before they pick up the knife and kill the monster in the final. So talk about how to create your take on this.
Yeah, so the girls in the horror movie is about these two twins, these two girls that were in a horror movie when they were kids, and they were like this little like monster in this horror movie, and now it's years later and they're all grown up, and the one still, they're kind of still stuck in this, even though that was their only real movie. You know, they're still kind of stuck in this past, and the one goes to horror conventions and she, you know, signs autographs, but like it's obviously of her as a kid. And so it's kind of like the way this movie follows them, but then the way the movie starts to kind of become sentient, and they start kind of the main one that is like the one that keeps going to the convention starts kind of seeing herself as a little kid kind of walking around the convention, but she's like, oh, maybe it's just a cosplay. And it kind of gets weirder and weirder from there. And I always love different perspectives. And I think, you know, it's so interesting to see a story from a perspective of somebody that's years later, and maybe they didn't become a super famous person, and they're just kind of living this life where they're sort of stuck in a cycle. That's a lot of something, you know, that's something I explore a lot of, being stuck in cycles. And, you know, how are they going to break out of it? Are they going to break out of it? Do they need to break out of it? And kind of exploring that idea through the perspective of somebody, you know, who was in this like well-known horror movie many, many years ago.
I just kept thinking of the two girls in The Shining.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that's definitely like part of the reference, even though in their movie, it's only one of them and they have just like twins. So they kind of switched off. But yeah, definitely like Shining Girls inspiration.
You know, you have a story called Melting Point, and this brings up a theme that recurs in the story. So I'm wondering if you have had any personal experience about this, about being a caregiver, somebody who lives with an older relative. This is something I've had experience in, and it's not fun. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. And you do, in the stories that in this book, they're both standout stories. The Melting Point is certainly one. It takes place in Three Mile Island. And one of the things I think you do well with this story and all the stories is to just throw your supernatural trope right into the story, right in the beginning, and there's just no way the reader questions it. You don't explain it that much. It's just happening, and it's really bad. I mean, heck, that's happening to this world right now. It's,
yeah.
Talk about you doing that, and also about this, the caregiver situations and your exploration of that.
Yeah. I like that you say that. I just kind of like, I do kind of get right to the supernatural elements a lot of times in stories, that it's just kind of like taken for granted, kind of, you know, that, okay, something very weird is happening right now. And, you know, they're trying to figure out exactly, you know, why this is happening. And it is, it's a story about two women. They live next to each other, and one is in a very toxic relationship with her kind of trucker husband, who's not there very often. And then the other one is a caregiver for her mother, who's also very toxic. Her mother was not, you get the impression, was not very nice even before she was having a lot of health problems. And now she's, you know, the main character is kind of in this loop again with this with her mother. And you know, I don't know that I've had a lot of experience with caregiving, but I've been around a lot of people who have, and I feel like, and you know, maybe as a kid, you know, I had a lot of sick relatives growing up. And so I wasn't maybe necessarily immediately the caregiver, but like I was there kind of seeing all of that. And it can be very hard. It can be tough anyways, even in the best of circumstances. But then especially in situations where it's like maybe the relationship wasn't that good even before you were a caregiver, and now you're a caregiver to someone who the relationship is not a positive one, and how hard that is, and how much, you know, that takes a toll on people, and kind of wanting to explore that in this main character.
One of the things too, I thought that was really interesting about that was the way that it kind of like, and horror does this, I think, extremely well, like blurs the line between the science fiction and the supernatural in the same way that, like, in the 30s, I think. You know, people thought, well, spiritualism is, you know, like very scientific. It's just like atoms, you know, you can't see them, but these things are really there and they work in certain rules. So talk about, you know, blurring the lines between reality and fiction and between horror fiction and science fiction.
Yeah, I think that that's such an interesting point, that it is so blurred at times. And when in horror, if there is a supernatural element, or maybe it's not supernatural, maybe it's got a natural explanation, I always make the joke that's kind of not a joke, that technically, if anything would be seemingly supernatural in this world, it really wouldn't be. There is no supernatural, there's just natural we haven't explained, right? There's not actually anything, like once we understand something scientifically, it's no longer supernatural. So things that like 100 years ago might have seemed supernatural, what we're doing right now, a Zoom call in which anywhere in the world you can talk to somebody, this would have seemed supernatural 100 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago, but definitely 100 or 200 years ago. But we understand it as science and technology now. So it's like there is no supernatural. There's natural that we don't understand yet. And so that's something I think about a lot of, like, you know, as I'm writing this, is this something that could happen? Is this something I really don't think could ever happen, but I just want to write about it, and kind of like exploring those different things. And with Melting Point, I think that's such a great thing to talk about, because it's like there was radiation that came out of Three Mile Island, and we know what radiation does from a scientific and medical perspective. So it's like when it starts having what are clearly supernatural within the story effects on one of the women, you know. It's initially they think it's radiation burns, because some people did describe getting radiation burns, especially if they were in shorts or in a swimsuit, and the one character is in a swimsuit the whole day when all the radiation is coming out. And so that kind of started it as something that actually did happen and can happen if you're exposed to radiation near a place that's starting to melt down. But then obviously things go very differently than what they went for anybody at Three Mile Island, because it goes much further past that. But it was something I was thinking about, and I was trying to kind of explore what can happen up to a point, and then kind of taking it that next step into something that goes beyond what we understand right now, at the very least.
That's an excellent version of the old Arthur C. Clarke quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic."
Yeah, exactly. It's so true. And it is something very interesting, especially like in the last 30 or 40 years, even the last 15 to 20, the amount of technological advances we've seen that we've just gotten used to. I mean, 20 or 30 years ago, we couldn't have imagined like carrying computers around in your like pocket or purse. Like computers were not even that common 30 years ago, right? Or 40 years ago for a lot of people. So it's very interesting how quickly we actually adjust to it. We're like, oh, this is just how it's always been. And it's like, it really hasn't always been like this, but we get used to it very quickly.
Yeah, that's I think one the great themes of the horror genre itself is that how easily people become accustomed to change, generally for the worse.
Yeah, right. I do think that's another thing that I think about sometimes of how human beings are very resilient. We are. We can endure a lot, but the problem is then sometimes we endure so much and then we just take it as, oh, well, this is just how it has to be. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to be like this. Maybe we can endure and survive like this, but we don't have to get used to it. And that is definitely kind of an existential horror thing of how much, you know, how low can we go and still survive and be like, well, I guess this is the best there is. And it's like, but it's not though. We can do better than this. So yeah.
There's a story titled Her Skin, a Grim Canvas. In the title itself, it tells you, the theme of this. And I think that one of the things I really liked about this, the unifying aspects of this, was that, how powerfully you get into the idea of, writing stories from women's point of view and the horror, essentially, that one, And just as you get 81 cents on the dollar, I think it was today, in terms of what women earn in the work marketplace, you get like about $1.50 worth of horror, where a man only made a buck's worth of horror. So, you talk about the. Her skin, a grim canvas.
Yes. So this one is from the perspective of a girl who's basically new to town, doesn't really have anybody, and she shows up at this party where there's this like very well-known, very weird avant-garde fashion designer, and he basically kind of plucks her as his new muse, and it gets very dark and body horror from there, and she starts realizing that, you know, there were all these muses before that nobody talks about, and it's very much, I'm going to give away a little bit by saying this, but it's got a very Bluebeard vibe of like the previous wives of Bluebeard, the previous muses of this fashion designer. And so that, you know, I love fashion, I do, but I can recognize that I love aspects of it, but it's also a toxic industry, like a lot of industries, really. And so to me, it's so perfect for horror. Like fashion horror is like one of my favorites. It's not something that it's done enough, but I do love it when it is done. And so that was something that I was like, I gotta write some fashion horror. So that was very much this one.
There's a story called The 11 Films of Una Cashford. And
Yes.
I was just reading about early horror filmmaker, Judy DeCorno or something. I can't. She has a new movie out now, actually.
Yes. Yes.
So talk about this story, which is it of the genre, fiction, nonfiction.
It's about Una Cashford, who's this filmmaker, obviously fictional filmmaker, but it's actually told like it's a booklet from a film festival, obviously a fictional film festival. I almost want to go to this film festival, even though like really supernatural and sometimes bad things happen during the screenings of her movies, but I still kind of want to go. But I wanted to imagine a world in which there had been even more female filmmakers, like in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and kind of through that era. There were certainly some. A lot of their movies haven't been kept up as much, but I do wish there had been more, because I think this story really came from the idea of like watching old William Castle movies like House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts, and some of them had these really fun gimmicks. Like there would be like, I think for the Tingler, they would have like things under the seats in some of the theaters that would start like vibrating like the Tingler. And you know, there was just a lot of fun. Like with 13 Ghosts, it was one of the early 3D glasses you would put on. And I thought it would be so much fun if like there had been a female filmmaker that had done all of these things. And that's kind of the initial inspiration for Una Cashford. Somebody else I was talking to recently had said that also they got a kind of Maya Deren vibe. And she was a great, like, avant-garde filmmaker that really went on to inspire David Lynch a lot. And so I have seen some of her work, so I love that comparison. And I feel like she was probably in there as inspiration to some extent as well. So there's like some different ideas from like the, I think she was in the 40s, maybe in the 50s. But yeah, so that kind of era of filmmaking.
I got a bit of a Philip K. Dick vibe too, with the plastic reality kind of themes of it. And I think, Philip K. Dick is a writer who writes a lot of science fiction, but some of his ideas are fairly terrifying, just in terms of, not knowing what's real and what's not real. Now, for me, a super standout was this story, The Mad Monk of Motor City. I just love that story. I thought it was great because, once again, there's a supernatural aspect that is you just handle, I think, really masterfully. And also, just I love the clinging to the middle class with terrified grip, ready to drop into almost homelessness. So talk about I think there's an economic and just a sexist vibe to the story. Not that it, but it explores the story itself isn't sexist, but you can see the result of our society in this. And also, once again, a lovely, awful story of caretaking.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought of this one as a caretaking story, but yeah, absolutely. That's very true. That's so interesting. I hadn't thought of it because when you said earlier, oh, there's another story in here that's a caretaker. I'm like, really? Which one? But yeah, this one is too. So the Mad Monk of the Motor City is about this woman, and she's living with her mother. And you're right, she's the daughter is the one who goes out and works and is really taking care of them. That's very true. And then the Mad Monk was the nickname for Rasputin. And again, a documentary that we watched when we were at home during the pandemic. And like Rasputin was awful. He was so terrible to women. Like he was just such a terrible person. And like, and I feel like that's known, but it's more like, oh, he influenced Russian history and the Tsar and the Tsarina. But like just the day-to-day of how he treated women was horrible. And I hadn't seen that explored as much when people would talk about Rasputin. So I had this idea of, I think, I came up with the idea, and then I love the title of The Mad Monk of the Motor City, because the Motor City is Detroit. And so it's, I call it my Rasputin in Detroit story, because one day this girl is like coming home from work and like, or leaving, I think she's coming home from work. And there's just the ghost of Rasputin standing in the hallway of her like super rundown apartment building. And like he's just right there, and she like scurries past him and hopes kind of at first, maybe I'm just kind of going crazy, maybe I'm just tired, maybe I'm just hallucinating this weird thing. But then as the story goes on, Rasputin starts sort of infiltrating these kind of like a lot of the very lonely, widows or lonely mothers and her mother, and starts just very much in like a cult kind of way, and the way he really was, because he almost had like a cult of personality, really. He's doing that to these women and these families that are in this, very economically perilous, like you said, apartment complex. And the main character is like the only one who's like very much like, no. There's like maybe one other person, like I think a younger girl that doesn't like this, but a lot of the people are just kind of starting to fall for the things he's saying and doing because they're so desperate. And she's like, what is going on? Like she's like the person in the room that is like, what are you all doing? This is the ghost of Rasputin, right? And they're like, and so it's like she's feeling almost like disoriented and gaslit because it's like, this is so ridiculous. Why is this happening? But, you know, she's got to deal with what's going on.
The idea of toxic relationships, you know, it seeps through this collection like a toxin itself. And I think AIDS is an excellent example of this, you know, of with the toxic relationships between women. Now, so talk about creating that story.
Yes, so AIDS is like my all-female sapphic Julius Caesar take. It was in Shakespeare Unleashed, which was all horror stories, you know, inspired by Shakespeare. And again, talking about cults, like it basically starts and it's this mostly female cult. I think initially there are some men in the cult, but I think they run off fairly early, I think is brought up. I know in the early draft I said that. I can't remember for sure if that made it through, but that was sort of how I initially imagined it. But by the end, it's all these women in this like doomsday cult. And they have this leader, Julia, and they realize that she's going to like bring about the end of the world. And so they're like, we have to stop her. Like they originally are like, oh, we're all in on this. And then they start kind of getting cold feet. And they're like, maybe we like the world. Maybe we don't want this. And so they come together like in Julius Caesar and they all stab her. And they hope that this is going to be the end of it. And it is not. What starts happening is like every year on the date of her death, she starts coming back to life and weird things keep happening. And they're like, maybe we didn't put off the end of the world, but maybe if we can just kill her for good, it'll happen. So it's basically the kind of almost like the murder of Julius Caesar, but over and over again in this like, you know, cult compound that these women are there. And then it does not, you know, killing her only kind of makes things worse as it goes on. And they you kind of keep having all these weird supernatural things occurring around them.
The girly E2 version of Groundhog's Day.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it is. Because I love the idea of, I mean, I don't really love it, but I find it scary, the idea of being stuck in cycles. To me, that's like one of the scariest things of like not being able to get out of a cycle that you don't like. So when I think, you know, what scares me? What do I want to write about? I always go back to those kind of cyclic things of like, oh, here we are again. We're here again. We should have learned better. We didn't learn better. We're going to try to learn better now and like trying to break out of it. And that's like, that is very much a recurring theme in my stories. And it's funny because I was born on Groundhog Day. And so when that movie came out when I was a kid, I was like, this is great. It's all about my birthday. And I thought, of course, as a kid that, oh, every day would be my birthday in that town. But like, obviously, it's still a horror story. And it's a horror movie in a lot of ways, because who wants to be stuck in the same day? And I think somebody figured it out. He would have been stuck there for like years and years and years to be able to do all those things. So yeah, that's very scary.
I think I was actually reading the story during the Ides of March. So
I love that. I meant to post about it earlier this month and be like, oh, it's going to be in my, of course, it was like the day after. And I'm like, oh man, I missed it. But next year I'm going to post on the Ides of March.
And you have a story called All the Hippies Are Dying, and to which I would might reply, I'm not dead yet. I'm just I was on the trailing edge of the hippie years. I was really too young to be a hippie. So talk about creating that story, which I thought was really fun to read, and you know, definitely dark. And that's one of the things about this collection is there are stories that are somewhat funny, but I think that by and large you really cling to the darkness. And so talk about, you know, keeping that somber mood but injecting variety in it by selecting a variety of places and characters.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I do think there is some humor throughout, because, you know, I feel like, you know, that kind of gallows humor is always helps to break up the horror in a lot of ways. But Yeah, this story in particular, All the Hippies Are Dying, it's probably in many ways the sort of lightest horror. It's more just dark fantasy than actually outright, like, you know, horror. But there is body horror in it. It's about this girl and her mother, and her mother was a hippie. She was at Woodstock. And, you know, then slowly the mother's family, you know, or friends that were there start to die off, and then the mother gets sick, and the cancer in her actually starts to sing, and when the doctor listens, it's actually playing the music from Woodstock. So it's like the idea of this being so much a part of this mother that even when she's getting sick toward the end of her life, it's like, you know, there's this music literally coming from her. And I thought that that was at once very dark, but also almost very comforting in a way. I mean, I think I kind of spoiled the story a little bit. It's fairly short, but like, you know, I do love this idea of having this music that has affected us and how it becomes a part of us in a way. And in this, that literally happens to the mother. And the daughter is like, again, it's kind of like a dynamic, like in the Rasputin story, that the daughter's like, this is wild. This should not be happening. And I kind of like that because I think a lot of times between generations or even between family members, you know, or partners, sometimes somebody's like, if we're with somebody, we can't understand the way they see the world. And so to me, that's what a lot of these stories are about, of like two people who might care about each other, but they can't see the world the same way. And you might have one person be like, why is this happening? And the other one's like, eh, I'm good with it, or whatever, and having that kind of disconnect.
One of the things I think that is interesting as we discuss this question is, on one hand, it's rather dark, but it's fun. And, you know, you have a lot of enthusiasm for this, which I think shows through in the writing. On one hand, it creates an almost a somewhat literary feel to this book, I think, because of the variety and also the quality of the writing. So talk about, you know, working on your prose and your perceptions. I think also the downmarket vibe of all of this. I mean, there are no, I mean, I guess the fashion maven is about as high as you get in terms of, you know, being kind of glittery and a star. Most so much fiction and so much, especially of other media, is really focused on people who are rich and famous or, you know, don't have problems. There's not a lot of focus on people who work at the dry cleaners. So.
It's true. Yeah, and she does work at the dry cleaners in the Mad Monk of the Motor City. So I love that you actually bring that up. It's true. And I do think that, you know, most of us, even if we aren't currently working, you know, those kinds of working class jobs, a lot of people have. So either people have that in their past or are currently working class jobs. But yeah, we tend to have a lot of stories more from perspectives that are more glamorous or maybe quote unquote more interesting. But, you know, that's not necessarily interesting to everyone, right? And I think we need the stories, you know, like you said, the glittering, you know, rich people, whatever, that's fine. There's certainly stuff to be said for exploring wealth and what that means, especially in America. There's definitely stories to be told about that. But I do agree that, you know, when you've grown up more working class, it's nice to see that depicted. And I tend to be more curious about the people kind of on the outskirts of the world or kind of pushed to the outskirts of the world. So it's like, you know, when you are going somewhere, you know, how is that server's day? Or how is the day of the person who's, you know, you're picking up your dry cleaning from? And like, everybody's got a story to tell. And it's, to me, I really like exploring those stories that maybe we aren't as eager or, you know, typically conditioned to hear about.
One of the things that, as I read through the stories in this book, I was reminded of the two novels of yours I've read, Reluctant Immortals and The Haunting of Elkwood. And I thought they were very different, and which I really liked. They were both kind of, they were both scary, or not scary in the super gory sense, but disturbing in what was implied. But the Reluctant Immortals is fun. You have all these characters from other books, and you have this kind of swinging 60s setting, which is also really enjoyable. You know, and it's a little bit lighthearted. The Haunting of Elmwood is a lot more. I would describe it in a way as literary, but not in the sense of mean or pretentious. It's just more like focused on this really weird aspect of where, you know, reality takes a left turn in some anonymous suburb. And you are from Ohio. You live in mid-America now. Talk about the influence of living in mid-America as opposed to living on the left coast or the right coast. I think that makes a difference in your perspective in writing.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, growing up, you know, in Ohio, in the Rust Belt. Now I'm south of Pittsburgh, but it's kind of still Rust Belt in this area in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I do think, again, that kind of working class vibe and, you know, the landscapes, which I do still think in many ways are very beautiful. I think, you know, my first novel was called The Rust Maidens, and it was actually about girls in the Rust Belt turning to like the rust and the rot of the environment. So it's definitely something that I find very, very interesting and definitely, as you know, sparks my imagination in a lot of ways. But yeah, also, you know, Haunting of Elmwood does take place. It doesn't give an exact place, but it is supposed to be in Ohio. Whereas, yeah, Reluctant Immortals is in California. It takes place in both San Francisco and Los Angeles and Hollywood. So those are very different vibes, you know. And I've spent some time in California, definitely not a lot. I love it there. I love it so much, especially coming from the Rust Belt in Ohio, where it's gloomy. It's so wonderful to go to Southern California, and it's always sunny. It's like so different than growing up in like the gloomy Rust Belt, where I think there's actually a place in Northeastern Ohio that like, I think they built something for like NASA there because it's so gloomy, and there's something about like the gloom. I think I've heard that they build things that like that way it's not as sunny. I don't know if it's like cloud cover so you can't see what they're doing. I don't know. I remember hearing about that as a kid, and like so many gloomy days, like we're like, it's a very gloomy area.
That sounds like something out of one of your stories.
It does. It totally does.
Now, this book concludes with the title story. And one of the things that I really liked about this is that it reminded me of the beginning of the Books of Blood, where you have a little intro story that ties all everything you've got together lightly. And this does, and this does the has an analogous raison d'etre. So talk about, you know, was this created specifically for this anthology? And then talk about, you know, it has a bit of a metafictional feel to it.
Yeah, definitely. So no, this one was actually previously published, but I just always kept coming back to it. So it's told from the perspective of Elizabeth Short, who's better known as the Black Dahlia. And the idea of it is that like, it's all these different haunted houses. The idea being that all the different places where we know she was killed. And then as people have all these different theories about how she died or where she died, because it's still an unsolved case, you know, she has to live through all of this stuff. So it's like, oh, if they have a theory that she was murdered here, that's one of her haunted houses. And she's stuck there for a while as people are like theorizing that that's what happened. And then she'll be stuck over here where there's another theory. And so she's kind of, again, put through this cycle of it. And she just wants to be left alone. She's just like, I just want to be my own ghost, basically, and not be put through this. And it does. It definitely has this kind of metafictional idea of like she's sort of aware of the stories that are being told, and then she's being affected by those stories. And, you know, really kind of dealing with how do we tell stories, especially about murdered women, but anyone, you know, anyone who's had like something tragic happen to them or died in a tragic way. How do we deal with that? And how do we talk about that? And is it always exploitive? Can we do it in a way that's not exploitive? And exploring that. And it's so interesting because even writing the story, you know, is that exploitive against her as a person? You know, because, you know, so it's interesting, like trying not to turn people into symbols and trying not to flatten them, but at the same time, trying to talk about kind of broader implications of what people's deaths could mean to or express about us as a society. I always say it's a mileage may vary. Some people might be like, I think this was very respectful to this person, and someone else might be, I think this was exploitive, and trying to kind of deal with that. And that's something that I'm trying to explore in the story.
You have a story called Sister Glitterblood, which is instructions for a game. Games are these days, it's a huge industry, bigger, we're told, than movies and TV combined. So, and it's also considered a great place for storytelling, which I'm old enough to say that idea evades me entirely. That said, I love this format. This is another piece of, ostensibly nonfiction fiction. I love that format. So talk about using the video game instructions for the basis as a horror story.
So Sister Glitterblood, it like starts out, it's like two or more players, and it talks, it's told as like this instruction manual for this board game that these two girls are playing. And it's these two sisters again, kind of in their house by themselves, and they start playing this game. But then they realize again, just like in some of the other things, like the game itself, it kind of knows it's being played and it's sentient. And as they're reading through the instruction manuals, which is the story, and that's the format of the story, they're aware that, they're getting in deeper. And so it tracks them over the years throughout playing this game, because they leave it, then they come back, they leave it, then they come back. And so it's kind of following them with these different rules and different things that are happening, and how do you win this game, and kind of playing with it in that way. I love board games. I love games in general. I'm doing puzzles with my husband. So I thought it would be fun to kind of take that format and say, okay, well, what does, what would happen to these characters if this happened? I remember watching the movie Jumanji as a kid, and like the idea of this game coming after you, and like, you have to finish it or something will happen. And I think that that's such a fun idea of, something that seems so fun and childlike, and something that's nostalgic and fun, and then it kind of can turn sour or dark in some way.
One theme that I'm sensing runs throughout this book, and also is in the other books, is that the toxicity that is often unleashed when you put two humans together. It's like, any two humans you put them together are like a binary poison. Via alone, we're safe. You put us together, it creates this kind of poison. So, talk about that, using that as a kind of a plot point, using the horror genre to explore that, because I think that's an interesting, perception. Yeah, you put me with most people, and you're gonna end up with some kind of, if not poison, a weird hallucinogen.
It's true. It is. There are so many different types of toxic relationships, right? And it's always interesting, like if you're in a friend group or even in a professional environment, and there can be two people that you might get along with both of them, but they do not get along with each other. And like you said, like there can be these kind of almost combustible situations that like you can sometimes be witness to, and sometimes you can be part of them. And it's like, it's interesting how, when you bring human beings together, how our personalities can either click or clash, and how sometimes you have no idea this is going to happen, or you go into an environment and it's just things just go wrong. And it's like, it can be misunderstandings. It's like, I've often heard it referred to as personality conflicts. I always love that. I do think that that's like the most diplomatic way. And there are times that, like, if you're in like a friend group and that happens, and it's like, oh boy. And so often people will want you to take sides. I always try, if I'm having a personality conflict with people, to just be like, my recommendation is to just stay out of it. Like, I don't immediately need, if somebody is friends with people like me and someone else, I'm like, just stay out of it. Don't put yourself in the middle of this. Don't throw yourself on the sword. Because so often it's like, even from the outside, you might not know what's going on, but from the inside, people can just come together and they just don't get along. And it is, things can go toxic so fast. And sometimes it really is like one person's just really mean mean or genuinely abusive. And that's one kind of like very severely toxic relationship. But sometimes I almost find it more interesting the smaller toxic relationships and trying to explore those aspects because it's like when it's really, really, really bad, it's easier as a person or even as a reader to be like, just get away. Like there's not any good there. But when you have some of these relationships where it's like a family member or a romantic partner and they're not abusive, but it's not good, things are coming together, things are clashing. Those smaller clashes can almost be more interesting because it's more difficult to navigate. It's not just get out. It's like, well, it's good sometimes, but it's bad in this way. And how do we navigate that as human beings? Because that can be tough. That can be some of the toughest things of just kind of living in the world day to day is trying to navigate those types of dynamics.
Well, our inclination as human beings is to put out fires with gasoline.
It's true. It's true. It's very true. And I know I'm guilty of that because I'm somebody who's like, okay, let's just put it all on the table. That's totally how I am. And sometimes it's like, maybe we shouldn't. But you know that. You know that. That's what's ironic about it. And sometimes I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And other times I'm like, I'm all in. And then afterwards I'm like, yeah, I mean, it is a way. At least everything's on the table. But at the same time, does it always make it better? Depends on the situation, depends on the people, right? Sometimes if you have two personalities and they just completely are like, here's how I'm thinking, here's how I'm feeling, you air all the grievances, then things can be better. Other times, like you said, that's just gasoline. So isn't that fascinating that even the same reactions, even if it's the same problem, you have different people, totally different reactions to those same things. So yeah, it's wild being human sometimes.
This is a short story collection from Raw Dog Screen Press. I love those guys. They did wonderful work. Are you working on a
Yes.
novel?
I am. Yes, my next novel is a sapphic werewolf novel due out next year with Union Square and Company, which is an imprint of Hachette. And in the meantime, in September, I have a Great Gatsby retelling. It's also a queer retelling called In These Gilded Ghostly Hearts. It's told from the perspective of Pamela Buchanan, who is Daisy's often forgotten daughter. And so that's, her mother dies, Daisy dies in this abandoned West Egg mansion, which turns out to be haunted and is, of course, Gatsby's mansion. And so her daughter has to kind of unravel the mystery of what happened to her mother. So that's coming out in September from Preacher. So that's my next book. And then the one after will be my novel next year. So yeah.
More mothers and daughters. I look forward to it. It's always complicated. I have been speaking with Gwendolyn Keith. Her new novel, or new collection of short stories, is The Haunted Houses She Calls Her Own. Thank you for joining me, Gwendolyn.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.